Wiggly superstar. Do you think you're what they say you are? Wiggly superstar. Do you think you're what they say you are?
It's showtime with Ricky Lee. Thank you for joining me here on 101.5 Huntley Community Radio, with streaming and podcasts available at huntleyradio.com. In theater, there are times when an actor performs a role so brilliantly that their footprint on the character is near iconic. Yul Brynner in The King and I is one example. Colm Wilkinson in Les Mis is another. Today, my guest is a Broadway performer who will forever be known as the definitive star playing the dual title roles in Jekyll and Hyde. Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle Award winner and Tony nominee, Robert Cuccioli. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hi, Ricky. Thanks so much for that intro.
Oh, we're so thrilled to have you on the show. And I definitely want to talk about Jekyll and Hyde and put some time aside for talking about your current projects. But okay, Before we do that, I wanted to give the listeners an idea about how you clawed and scratched your way to the top. I mean, you paid your dues long before Jekyll and Hyde. You actually started off in a fallback career as a financial consultant. At what point did you take the jump and leave the safety net of that job behind?
It didn't take me long. I went to school for finance. I was on the road to become a corporate lawyer. I don't know why. I guess it was just something that, my parents kind of put in my head, and I just kind of went along with it. However, I always acted. I acted in community theater and in school, and I was in a rock band, and I was in glee clubs. I always had a musical background. It was kind of in me. But I never thought of it as a career until I was my senior year of college, and I was doing a play, a musical. I was doing Godspell, actually.
Oh, okay.
At St. John's University, where I was getting my finance degree. And it was at that time when the light bulb went off, and I just said something I really enjoy, and people said I'm good. So I said, if I don't try this, I'm going to say, what if all my life? So I set out to discover this career, and I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anybody in it. It was all trial and error, and to a large extent, it still is. But I worked on Wall Street for about 3 years. I worked for a company called E.F. Hutton. Most young people, I have no idea what that is, but we old timers probably remember it very well.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very well-known brokerage house. Then I worked on Wall Street. And I worked there for about 3 years. And in the time I was there, I did auditions, and I continued with a band. And it was about halfway through my time on Wall Street at E.F. Hutton that I got a job at the Light Opera of Manhattan, which was a repertory company in Manhattan that did Gilbert and Sullivan and operettas. They worked 52 weeks out of the year, did a new show every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And they cast me in the chorus, making $35 a week. Huh. And I did both for about a year and a half. I worked on Wall Street during the day, and I did theater with the Light Opera of Manhattan at night until I started getting roles, and I had to be there in the afternoons to rehearse as well. So I couldn't do both after a while, and I finally made the choice, and I gave up Wall Street, and I never looked back.
Fantastic. Now, your first really big break was playing Lancelot in the U.S. National and Canadian Tours of Camelot, opposite Richard Harris as King Arthur. How did landing that role change your life?
How did it change my life?
Yeah.
Well, it actually was the first time that my parents actually bought into the idea of me being an actor. Because till that point, they were, my dad sort of went along with it. I mean, he understood what I, you know, the calling. He understood the desire, because he actually was a musician at one time when he was a lot younger, before he became a civil engineer. So he knew the desire to do that, but he was, you know, mostly my parents were mostly afraid of, you know, me failing or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much the career; they just didn't know anything about it. Until I actually got to work with a star that they recognized. And it was at that time, and also Richard Harris was, you know, singing my praises. So it was at that time when they kind of bought into the idea of me being an actor, and they were very proud of that.
Very good.
So that changed my career in their eyes. But also, it just started to establish me as a leading player. So that was important in that regard.
Now, I would imagine that you learned a lot from Richard Harris. Are there any examples of things that you learned playing opposite such a legendary performer?
You know, because I had no official theater training, I didn't go to school for it. And it was a while before I started actually training as an actor. I learned by watching.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what I did, I would always stand in the wings when I was not on stage and watch other actors do their thing. And that was my training ground. Seeing how other people succeeded, what they did, how the audience reacted to it. And then my initial reaction was to copy that. And then I mutated it into my own style of that. So Richard was the greatest training ground, because whether I was on stage with him or when I was off stage, I would always watch him. And he was a great mentor, even though he didn't really realize it. I could see when he was, you know, kind of marking it, and I can see when he was really in it. I could see the difference, and I just learned a lot from him.
Fantastic. Now, your first Broadway role was Javert in Les Mis in 1993. Was your Broadway debut all you envisioned it to be?
It was, you know, I don't know what you would ever envision something like that to be, but I think it exceeded exceeded that in excitement, and just because it was completely not what I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to be in Les Mis ever since I first heard the music when it was still in London. I had a cassette tape that I just played over and over and over again till you can no longer hear it. It's a show that I always wanted to do. And I always wanted to play Enjolras, the student leader.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the hero. And I auditioned for the show, I think 6 times for that role, and I never got it. And then I was auditioning for something completely different. It was a musical review, and Richard J. Alexander, who at that time was the general manager of Les Mis, he was the producer of this show, and he was in the room when I auditioned, and I gave probably one of the worst auditions of my life, and I walked out of there with my tail between my legs, you know, going home. And Richard came running up behind me, and he said, "Bob, you did really good in there, but we have an opening coming up in Les Mis for Javert. Would you be interested?" And I was like, yeah. So they finally called me in to audition for it, and he said, you will play this role. I don't know when just yet, but you will. And within about 3 months, they called me up and they said, okay, our Javert is leaving, and we'd like you to come in and replace him. And it was totally unexpected. It's not what I thought was going to happen, and that's how life is.
That's a great story. once you were in Les Mis, what did you do to make Javert your own role?
They were really wonderful there. I don't know, number wise what Javert I was, but the show had been running for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much said, look, this is your sandbox. And as long as you stay within the sandbox, you can do whatever you want. So I'm like, great. So I came in with my own ideas. I made my own choices, and they said, that's great. Now can you roll that back a little bit? And they were very smart, because they gave me all the leeway that they could possibly give me by letting me feel like I was in total control of what I wanted to do with the role, when in effect they knew what they were doing so that they could give me that feeling that I was creating it myself. And then they reeled it back in a little bit, and they reeled it back in until I fit their mold a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
I still was doing what I wanted to do. I still made it my role. Nobody can copy anybody else 100%. You end up bringing yourself to a role no matter what. One instance that I remember was that I read in the novel. I read the entire novel when I got the role. I read in the novel that there was one passage, and I can't remember. I may be paraphrasing this, where it said that the only way you would know that Javert was in a mental disarray was that he had one button unbuttoned on his uniform. So I made the choice of unbuttoning one button at a certain point in the show. And I got called into the stage manager's office, and they said, you can't do that. And I said, well, it's in the Bible. It's in the novel. So they said, show me. So I brought it in. I showed it to the stage manager, and she said, okay.
Wow.
So I did that for a couple of shows until the costume designer caught wind of it. And she said, no, you please, you can't do that. So I'm like, all right, well, I can't argue with you. So I had to button up again. But that's one of the instances that happened in making the role my own.
You're listening to It's Showtime with Ricky Lee on 101.5 Huntley Community Radio, with streaming and podcasts available at huntleyradio.com. Today, I have the huge honor of interviewing legendary Broadway star Robert Guccioli. Now, Robert, in 1994, you landed the dual roles that you came to define, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Can you share what the audition process was like?
The audition process was pretty lengthy. I was actually doing Les Mis at the time, and I got called in to audition, and I was given a couple of pieces of music, and I think that was it at the time. I don't know that I was given any scenes. So I came into the audition, and nobody was there except for Frank Wildhorn. The producer could not make it. They missed the producer and the director both missed their flight from Houston, or it got canceled or something. But they were not there. The only person in the room was Frank Wildhorn and the accompanist. And I sang my songs, and then Frank called me over to the piano, and we sang through quite a lot of the score. I sight sang it.
Okay.
And he said, that was great. We'll call you back in. So I'm like, terrific. So a couple of months go by, maybe 3 months go by. They call me back in again. And this time everybody made their flight. So I did the songs and I did the themes. And everyone said, that's terrific. We'll call you back in. I'm like, great. So 1 month goes by, 2 months go by, 3 months go by. They call me back in again. I audition again. And they're like, great, you'll be hearing from us. I'm like, wonderful. So in the meantime, I go on vacation. I'm in California, and I'm still doing Les Miserables. I just took a week off, and I went on vacation. I was in California. And I got another call from my agent saying that they want you to come back in for another work session. And I said, I can't. They wanted me to come in like the next day.
Oh, right.
And I said, I can't. They've seen me 3 times. And I'm away, and I'm not going to be back for, you know, another week. So they said, okay. So my agent called them up, told them that, and I stayed out in California. I felt like I probably did a really stupid thing. I flew back on a Sunday. That Monday morning, I got a phone call. I got the job.
Wow.
So you never know. Sometimes no is an enticing word.
Very good. Very interesting. Now you made your debut performance in Jekyll and Hyde as a joint production between Houston's Theater Under the Stars and the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle in 1995. At the point that you were offered the title role in Jekyll and Hyde, did you know the play was going to fill your life for the next few years before opening on Broadway?
No. Well, no. I think in my heart I knew that this was something special. First of all, I don't think I had been involved in something before that was a potential of coming to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought of failure, for lack of a better word, did not cross my mind that it would not go somewhere more.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was working with pretty incredible people. I knew that this was a remarkable piece. I knew the music was extraordinary. I knew that there were Broadway producers involved. I didn't think so much about whether it was going to come in or not. I didn't, but I knew that I was involved with something important. And actually, the Richard J. Alexander, who I had mentioned before, who was the general manager of Les Mis, he knew it was important too, and he let me out of my contract for Les Mis to do Jekyll and Hyde. He didn't have to do that. So I tell him all the time that I owe him for that.
Now tell me about creating such iconic roles. Where did you find the inspiration for two such divergent characters?
Well, I drew from the text. That's generally, you know, where an actor has to start in order to create the character. What the text is telling me is what I got most of my information. But I also read the novella, and it was from the novella, actually, where I got the idea of making Hyde left-handed and Jekyll right-handed, because there was a certain passage in there that said that Dr. Lanyon, who was a combination of basically two characters in the musical, got a letter from Dr. Jekyll, but it was his handwriting, but it had a backward slant to it. And that made me feel like, I mean, I've seen people who write left-handed, and their handwriting usually has a backward slant to it.
Mm-hmm.
I know one of my sisters is left-handed, and she does that. So that's where I got that idea from. As far as the physicalizations or the vocal characters. I mean, I go a lot by instinct, and it just when I think of like Hyde, I think of animal and where to place that kind of energy. I would watch animal films. You know, I'd watch how a panther moves, how a wolf moves, and I'd put that in my own body, and I'd find that kind of center of gravity, and the voice came along with that. And Jekyll was a, you know, it was a character more that led from the head and heart, and that helped with that posture, that helped with that voice. So it's well, I start with the text. If there is other research material, a novel or something or a movie that something is based on, I will watch or read that, and then I'll do some other, you know, deeper diving research.
Now you have a new project going on, Eugene O'Neill's A Touch of the Poet, done virtually. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, thanks for picking that up. Before COVID shut down everything last year, I was embarking with the Irish Repertory Theater to do a production of A Touch of the Poet, Eugene O'Neill's A Touch of the Poet. I had never done any O'Neill before. So this was my first, and it's an incredible role. It's an incredible piece, a challenging role. And I was very excited about doing it. And we got through rehearsals and just about to start tech when the world shut down.
Wow.
So thankfully, we got a chance to at least rehearse it. Now, the Irish Rep very creatively found a way to film the show. They got permission from our unions, and we all did it virtually from our own houses.
Oh, wow.
We filmed on our cell phones. They shipped us a green screen. They shipped us our costumes, makeup, wigs if need be, and set pieces and props. And we all listened to each other on Zoom and filmed on our own cell phones. And the whole process took, I think it was 8 days of shooting. And they took all that footage and edited it into a film. Sort of like a masterpiece theater type of project, where they actually were able to, the editor did a brilliant job and was actually able to put numerous people on the same screen, and they looked like they were in the same room. We filmed that last September. It aired in, I believe, August, September. It aired somewhere like September, October. And now it is part of a winter festival that the Irish Rep is doing virtually, with a number of other projects that they filmed in that same way. So that's airing now. And none of this precludes us doing the show on stage when things open up again. So I'm looking forward to actually playing the piece for an audience.
Now, if you'd like to see Robert Guccioli in this magnificent role, there will be on-screen performances February 12th and February 16th. For more information, you can go to Irish Repertory Theatre's website at irishrep.org. There is also a link at robertguccioli.com. Robert, what advice would you give to a performer who is thinking about a career in entertainment?
Oh, my dear. Well, if you can do anything else, by all means, do it. But if this is what you must do, I mean that in regard that this is what your heart, this is what your soul tells you you must do, and there is nothing else that you can or want to do, then one needs to do it with all their heart and all their soul. And you need to train, train, train. And to watch and respect performers that have come before you. And watch what they do, watch what they've done, and learn from it. And also realize that you're never done learning, ever. It's a craft, and one never completes what they have learned in a craft. It's like saying a doctor has a practice. You're constantly practicing. You're constantly working at it. You're constantly bettering yourself, and one has to always go into this profession with that in mind.
You've been listening to It's Showtime with Ricky Lee. Today, my guest has been the incredibly talented Broadway leading man, Robert Coccioli. I encourage you to check out Robert's recordings, including Jekyll and Hyde the musical, Rothschild and Sons, Angels the musical, and The World Goes Round, and his solo album, The Look of Love. Visit Irish Repertory Theatre's website, irishrep.org, for ticket information on viewing Robert Coccioli starring in Eugene O'Neill's A Touch of the Poet on February 12th and 15th and 16th. Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for making this fan's day.
Same here, Ricky. I really enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure to be on with you.
Very good. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Same to you.